Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our show, and this is our second series of shows, episodes, on the war in Vietnam, and we have been very positively received, and so we're doing more interviews with vets, and the person we're going to be interviewing today is John Podlaski. Did I get that right, John?
Yes, sir.
All right. I've got names that I sometimes don't get right. So, all right, today I'm batting 1,000. John, you served time in Vietnam, and I guess that almost sounds like a prison sentence, doesn't it, when I say you served time in Vietnam. But tell me where you live now and what you're doing right now.
I'm in Sterling Heights, Michigan.
Okay.
And I've written 5 books so far, 3 on Vietnam and 2 short stories.
Okay.
And I also manage a website called CherriesWriter.com that contains articles, pictures, songs, anything that you want to know about warriors of Vietnam.
Okay. And where is explain to me where that is in what big cities are you next to? Anything?
I'm about 10 miles northeast of Detroit.
Okay. So 10 miles northeast of beautiful downtown Detroit. I really appreciated all your comments that you put in here. And one of the questions that I've asked everybody is, what were your first impressions when you, did you go by air to Vietnam or did you go by boat?
No, I went by air.
Okay. And so where did you land? Did you land in Da Nang?
Landed in Tan Son Nhut, which is right next to Ben Hoa.
Okay. And what were your first impressions when you landed?
Well, like everybody, as soon as I stepped into the doorway, the rush of hot air hit us with the various smells. And the thing that struck me the oddest was that we flew in by commercial airline. And in my case, it was Pan American.
Uh-huh.
And that was something that was not believed that was going to happen, that, hey, there's a war going on. We would be shot at as soon as we landed. And quite frankly, none of that was evident because everybody was walking around, even without weapons. And it was hard to fathom that, hey, we were in a war zone now.
Yeah. It is interesting. So many different... Well, the one thing that's very common is what you said is that, you know, people have said it was hot, it was humid, it was, you know, you could chew the atmosphere. And the other thing was that some of the planes landed and were being fired upon as they landed, and they could see impact, the shells hitting the ground. And then some came in on C-130s, some came in a commercial, and So after you landed in Vietnam, where did you go then?
Well, what they did after they signed us in country, we all got on buses, and as you mentioned earlier, a prison sentence. These buses were odd because they had bars and chicken wire covering the openings. There was actually no glass windows. Uh-huh. And as we were driving through the villages to go to our replacement center, villagers were squatting, you know, and taking care of their personal business on the side of the road. Some of the women were smiling at us, and their mouth looked like they had pieces of coal in it. And to us, it was, wow, what's this? You know, and then we learned it was a narcotic that they chewed called a betel nut that caused their teeth to be that way. But we drove about a half hour to another base, which was our reception area, and we stayed there for 3 days before we were driven to our unit. In my case, it was the 25th Infantry Division.
Mm-hmm. Interesting you mentioned about the betel nut, because on our first series we did on Vietnam, we made a poster. And one of the posters is one of the mama-sons, you know, she's smiling, but it, you know, her teeth are so black, it doesn't look like she has teeth, you know. Very interesting. And so then you were assigned. It sounds like you spent pretty much all the time that you were there in infantry and out in the field. Is that correct?
Yeah, 100% of it was infantry. I spent 7 months in the 25th Division carrying a machine gun, and later a radio for the lieutenant in our platoon. And the 25th was wrapping things up and going back home to Hawaii. They were taking soldiers with them that had 10 months in country. Mm-hmm. And since I only had seven, all those with less than 10 months were reassigned elsewhere.
Okay.
Best friend of mine went to Chulai to the Maricel Division, and I went with a couple of people I knew up to the 101st Division up near Wei and Da Nang in that area, and carried the radio for the command platoon for the next 5 months before I came home.
How much does that radio weigh? That's pretty heavy, isn't it?
About 24 pounds.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. And what were, you know, one of the questions I've always asked people, too, is what were, you know, you were how old when you were in Vietnam? What was your age?
Say that again?
What was your age when you were in Vietnam?
Oh, 19.
So, you know, one of the things that we've talked about is that it just seemed like, you know, we kind of just grabbed these kids out of, and I graduated in 66. We grabbed these kids out of the fields and I lived in a little small farming community, and, you know, took them out of a very comfortable situation to, you know, a totally different environment, so foreign to them. What were the things that you remember seeing that are the kinds of things that you never thought you'd see as a kid and will never forget?
Well, I guess just like any soldier out in the field, the one thing that he'll never forget is going to be the first time he's in a battle, but then afterwards it's surveying the scene of the battle. So not only do you see dead enemy soldiers, but you also see dead friends that you had, or severe wounds of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And those are probably the top two things that will jump out at you. Dreams will come later of the firefights and things of that nature, but you never forget seeing death firsthand.
Yeah, and of course, at the age of 19, you see it very, at that age, you kind of think you're invulnerable, and other than grandma or grandpa or somebody old in the family who has died, you just have never been exposed to that. And that's got to be a real, real life changer. So, and now tell me about this. You said you got bit by a snake.
Yeah, we were on a mission. It was raining that night, and we had set up our positions around the perimeter, and I was sitting underneath a poncho hut, eating my sea rations. We were about ready to cash in for the night because it was getting dusk, and there was a snake that I saw that was as big around as my index finger and maybe about 12 inches long that came slithering in the mud, and he passed my position and started going to the next position, and I sort of hollered out a warning, and the guy jumped out and started smacking around with his rifle, and he was gone. He was forgotten. I got done with my meal, and I turned around and put everything away in my rucksack, and he was sitting there on my rucksack, and he snatched onto my ring finger and wouldn't let go. I was shaking and shaking, and finally he flew off. God knows where he landed. But within 10 minutes of being butt, I had gone into convulsions, and they decided to call a medevac helicopter in and take me to the medevac hospital, where they had me looking through pictures in a book to try and identify the snake. And I spent the next 7 days there in the hospital, and it turned out to be a banded crate, which is the second most dangerous snake in Southeast Asia. The first would be the bamboo viper, which they call three-step snake.
Yeah, the three-step. Because you were
dead
after.
You were down within three steps.
Right, right. Yeah, was that pretty painful, too? I mean, I would assume it was, yeah.
Well, it was more like feeling, I was going to have a heart attack, because I was just scared to death as to what happened. Everybody else had to pack up my stuff and move to a different location because the helicopter landing exposed them and they couldn't stay there overnight. But people that were with me remember that night.
Hmm. That's interesting because I know that was one of the issues. That once you brought a many of my friends that I went to high school with worked on helicopters, and also one of them was a gunner on a Huey, and they said that once they went in and they landed at a specific LZ landing zone, that noise was so overwhelming that you had to get out of there quick because the Viet Cong would know exactly where you were and would head for that area. So tell me about this, and also you mentioned in here about an ambush or something where you went out and
that was one of the things too that you say that stands out. One of my fellow soldiers and I happened to go out on a two-man recon, and we followed a trail for about a half a mile through the jungle. It was kind of open, and we just wanted to see what we could see. And oddly enough, in the middle of the jungle, there was like a Western horse, I forget what you call it now, one of them hitching posts where you had... two trees and then another one coming across, and everything was secured by vines and no horses anywhere. Couldn't understand why that was there, but we turned around, we came back and reported it. And the next morning, two more squads went out to investigate what we had found, And 15 minutes into their hunt, they got ambushed on the same trail we were in. And turns out there was a base camp on the side of the trail that we had inadvertently walked past and were left unmolested, because they know that probably the following day or whenever there would be more soldiers coming along, and that would be more for them to ambush. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, that's one thing that pretty much everybody has said is, that I've also talked to, is that the Viet Cong were very resourceful and very good fighters in the jungle situation, especially considered, you know, how they didn't have the technical equipment, but, you know, had the jungle know-how. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Viet Cong have been fighting since World War II, you know, against the Japanese and Chinese and French and Americans. And their places in the jungle have been, you know, the Iron Triangle
right, is
notorious. The Kuchi area, I mean, they built tunnels that went for miles. They had underground hospitals. They had underground way stations for soldiers filtering into Vietnam from the Ho Chi Minh Trail, where they could rest and replenish and get their ammunition and such. So, you know, out of all the soldiers that were in Vietnam, only 10% actually were out in the field doing the patrols. The other 90% supported us.
Yeah.
With helicopters and food and supply and, you know, so on. So 10% of 2.7 million soldiers, just over 15 years going through the jungle, you could go 5 years and not discover a place. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I had a friend I went to high school with who was a tunnel rat. And that is not a job I would, from what he told me about it, not a job that, you know, I would want going down into a tunnel.
No, me neither.
With a 45 and a flashlight. Not exactly an impenetrable shield. Tell me a little bit about here. We talked about the good, if you had a good luck charm. I thought this was kind of fascinating. You used a tracer round?
Yeah, on the first night out in the field in the fire base, I clipped a 50 caliber round off a belt, pried the bullet out, and then lit the incendiary inside the bullet to get all of the red dye out of there and,
right,
and hollow it, so to speak. Then got some wire and fashioned a hook, filled it in with dirt and mud. Packed it in, and I wore that around my neck as a good luck charm for the next 12 months.
That's kind of
it. And leaving to come home, they wouldn't allow me to bring it home, so I had to leave it in a contraband box.
Why wouldn't they let you leave it? I mean, it sounds to me like it was the ultimate of retro jewelry, you know.
Well, you would think so, but anything with a bullet or whatever, they wouldn't let it out of the country.
Wow. And it sounds like also you had a situation where when you were in basic, you almost didn't make it out of basic because of... tell me that, explain that to me.
Well, every night in basic training, you usually had an hour to yourself near dusk, where you congregated outside, smoked cigarettes, you cleaned up your personal stuff and whatsoever. And the camaraderie of soldiers began even in basic. You know, once you all suffered the same and crawled through the same dirt and did the same thing, you sort of feel that kinship between you. There were some guys outside, and all of a sudden you hear a ruckus where I think there were three or four other soldiers that approached them and were trying to rob them. And everybody inside the barracks emptied out to support them. And I was one of the ones in the front, bigger guy, you know. So I wasn't afraid to take them on. And as I approached him, one guy shoved me, and I didn't see a box cutter that he had in his hand, but he had slit my throat.
Wow.
And I didn't know it. I ran back into the barracks to get my shovel, and I was going to use the shovel as a weapon. And one of my mates in the barracks saw me just bleeding through, and he set me down and put a tourniquet around my neck and called the sergeant of the guard, and they ended up taking me to the hospital. But these guys got away and eventually were captured and prosecuted, so I don't know what happened, but I ended up with over 40 stitches in my neck, inside and out.
Wow.
And the good thing was that it kept me on KP for the next 5 days, and I was able to miss the gas chamber.
Oh.
So I may be one of the few Army soldiers that never experienced CS gas, you know, during training. And they were good enough to let me graduate with the class, so I didn't have to go and be assigned to another unit and complete the 8 weeks of basic training.
Wow, wow. One of the things we talk about, and I hear people saying a number of things, are, and you responded to here, positives and negatives about being in Vietnam. Is it fair to say there were both? And could you discuss that? You want to talk about negatives first?
Well, I'm trying to see where my notes were on this one.
That's okay. You were just saying, one of the things you said that was a negative was that everybody that you served with expected to be killed.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. No, that we all came over from training and landing in Vietnam because it was drummed into our heads for 4 months that we would die in Vietnam and there was no way that we were coming back. So as you had mentioned earlier about being at 19 feeling infallible, you know, and nothing is going to happen to you, you sort of developed I really don't care attitude and just continued serving so that at the end of 12 months when you're on a plane coming home, you're sort of just sat there in awe that you did survive.
Wow. And talk about the kids you saw in Vietnam.
There was, well, the parents... the only ones that you saw out in the field working were the old grandmas and grandpas. Everybody else of military age were serving either, you know, with the Viet Cong or with the Arvin troops. But that left tons of children, you know, in these villages and roaming the streets and such, anywhere from the age, well, of newborns to maybe 10 years old. The girls, 8-year-old girls, are holding two babies in their arms and keeping their brothers, you know, in check and then making sure everybody's okay. But cutest kids you ever seen. I mean, they didn't have a worry. It was, you felt sorry for them. All they had were the clothes on their back. Most of them were barefoot. But we used to give them candy and cigarettes and stuff of that nature. In return, they would give us ice-cold Coca-Colas and sell them for a dollar, which, you know, not having any... You have to understand, not having anything cold for... weeks at a time sometime, and then getting a nice cold Coke, there's nothing as refreshing as that to go down your throat.
You sound like you could be a promoter for Coca-Cola. Nothing so refreshing as a Coca-Cola. But I like that.
No, we carry canteens, and the canteens were tepid water. You know, there was nothing ice cold there to drink in the field. So when you came across these villages, you know, and the kids had pop for sale, I mean, that was a treasured treat.
I'm sure, yeah. One of my friends I taught with when I in 1971, he was a supply person out in the field, and he one time stole a bunch of ice from the captain's quarters and got beer way out in the field to everybody out there. And let me tell you, he was the king of the world at that time when he got beer on ice out in the field. So, what were your thoughts when you got back to the United States after? I mean, you said it was kind of unreal that you thought just the fact that you were alive. And how were you treated when you got back?
Well, everybody knew that when we got back, there was going to be a steak dinner, you know, and we'd get new clothes and so on. So that was expected. But as soon as the plane took off and we were over the ocean, the captain had made mention of it, and there was just a big cheer that erupted in the plane. Once we landed, we went to Japan, and then we landed in Alaska, and then finally in Spokane, up at the, I think it was Travis, maybe I'm wrong, but there was a base
in Spokane, Washington?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, what is it? Fairchild Air Force Base. My wife is from Spokane, so.
Okay, well, we stopped there, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning. We got our dinners, we had our clothes, and then things started circulating that, hey, you don't want to go out there with a uniform on, you know, the protesters are out there. They're going to do you in. Do whatever you can to make people aware that you weren't serving. But here you got the shortest hair of anybody around. So how are you going to disguise yourself to go through the people there as a non-vet? But there were people still at the gate. You know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, they were busing us to Spokane to. In Seattle, both, to catch planes to go home. And in the airport, it was the same thing. You had protesters throwing eggs at you and other different things, empty cans. And they told us, whatever you do, don't get into a fight with these people, because that's what they were looking to do. Wow. So most of us were in shock anyway, because we couldn't believe that we were being treated like that, and we were like zombies, you know, just continue on your way and go where you were going. And fortunately, they would not allow the protesters into the gate area, so at least we had some peace of mind there. Yes. Once I got on the plane, I mean, there were people buying me a beer and celebration and so on. I wasn't even old enough to drink. I was going to be 20 here in a little bit, but still, the age back in Michigan was 21. Wow. And the stewardesses didn't care. Everybody was celebrating in a plane that, and there was 8 or 9 of us that was on this particular flight. All but 3 got off at Chicago, and then the 3 of us got off in Detroit.
Wow. What a turnaround, 180-degree turnaround. And I think that just about finishes up our time here. But would you send me information on your books and anything like that that we can use to give to other pass on to other people that might be interested in that. And
sure.
Any other pictures you want to send me, it'd be great. And we appreciate your time, John. And we'll say hello to Chris Gaynor for you. So
yeah, appreciate it.
Okay,
give him my love.
Thank you very much. I will give him all of your love. You take care.
All right, Steve.
Take care and have a good day.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.